Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. And I welcome everyone here to our 97th episode. And today we are talking about a novel approach for treating myeloma using T cells. My co-host for the talk is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. And supporting Gary on the panel are our myeloma survivors and advocates, Jack Aiello, Cynthia Schmilewski, Pat Killingsworth, and Jennifer Alstrom. A lot of research is being done in immunotherapy for myeloma that is leading to new treatment options for patients. And we are talking to Dr. Ivan Borello, Associate Professor of Oncology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine today. Dr. Ivan Borello of Johns Hopkins is working on a completely novel approach. This involves enhancing white blood cells to create a customized immunotherapy for patients. The T cells from the patient's bone marrow are extracted, enhanced, and expanded in the lab and are given back to the patient, allowing for a more specific immune response targeting the proteins found on their myeloma cells. The use of bone marrow T cells is more precise than the use of cells from the blood, which makes this therapy more effective. Join our myeloma panel talk on this new area of research as they discuss the difference between CAR T cells and marrow-infiltrating lymphocytes and how body's natural immune cell growth can be used to fight myeloma. Before I hand over to Gary to carry on with the discussion, I would like to remind the audience that we will be addressing questions sent in for the panel towards the end of the discussion. If you have a question for Dr. Borello, you can mail it to priya@trialx.com or press 1 on your keypads and let us know so that we will bring you on air to ask your question. With that, it's over to Gary.
Well, thank you, Priya, and thank you again for bringing such a wonderful doctor to the myeloma patient community. Dr. Ivan Borello is a MD and Associate Professor of Oncology and Associate Professor of Cellular and Molecular Medicine for the Graduate Program and Director of Cellular Therapeutics Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Borello's team of researchers has focused on the development of tumor immunotherapy for blood cancers. This approach is breaking new ground and is a pioneering effort by his team. Dr. Borello has received numerous awards, including the American Society of Clinical Oncology Scholarship Award, the Johns Hopkins University Clinician Scientist Award, and the Kimmel Scholar Award and Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of America Clinical Translational Scholar Award. I'd go through the rest of his background and all, but it is stellar, and I want to leave plenty of time for questions from all the panelists. I did note that when I went through his biography on the Johns Hopkins site, he has a tremendous background, and most of his biography happened to be focused on this specific methodology. He spent years and years of research and putting his shoulder to the wheel type of thing to come up with this research. It's not something that's happened overnight, and I thank you very much, Doctor, for being here with us.
My pleasure.
First and foremost, I'd like to have you, if you would, just go through some of the very basics for listeners. Our listeners are generally not doctors, but are patients, and as a result, don't necessarily have the background in a lot of what you'll be talking about. So, if you could spend a short time in explaining what is the difference between immunotherapy and chemotherapy, and how your approach differs from immunotherapies that we've heard of recently, like daratumumab and elotuzumab, which have recently been approved by the FDA.
Sure. So in general, chemotherapy tends to be, at least traditionally, small drugs that target cells that are proliferating, that are growing. And this does not necessarily specific to cancer. It kills any cell that happens to be growing. It just turns out that in most patients with cancer, and myeloma certainly falls into this category, that cancer cells tend to grow at a slightly higher rate than normal cells, and so you get this preferential killing of the cancer cells compared to the normal cells. Because it's not specific, however, you also get a lot of side effects. And that's why with traditional chemotherapy, you know, patients can lose their hair because hair follicles are rapidly growing. They can also develop nausea and diarrhea because the cells of the GI tract are also rapidly growing. And once they're killed, they can't absorb water as much, and so you can get diarrhea. And all the other side effects that I think most people are aware of in terms of chemotherapy, either because they've experienced it or they know people that have. Furthermore, what chemotherapy does, being that it's a drug, is that it kills, and then once the drug is degraded, in order to achieve that effect again, you have to give the drug again. What immunotherapy does is, it's more targeted therapy, so it will only attack oftentimes the cells that it is primed to recognize. And for the most part, you can think of immunotherapy in two ways. One is a therapy that is sort of given as a drug through the veins, such as an antibody like daratumumab or elotuzumab, as you just mentioned, which one has just been approved this week and another one will likely be approved soon, or T-cell therapy, which you give through the veins, or there are vaccine approaches, which generally what that entails is an injection under the skin of something that recognizes the myeloma, and then what that does is ultimately educates the patient's body to develop an immune response against it, and so it can then, these immune cells can then travel around the body, and when they meet the myeloma cell, they can attack it and kill it. This is the same concept by which for which vaccines work in a preventive measure against infections, such as the flu vaccine. Although infectious vaccines tend to be more prophylactic, in other words, they're given before the patient actually has that specific disease. So sort of summarizing, immunotherapy tends to be more tumor-focused and specific, and for the most part, although we'll probably get into this later, has a relatively low side effect profile, and chemotherapy is much more generalized and tends to attack cells that are rapidly growing.
And chemotherapy, we would consider drugs like melphalan, Cytoxan, Velcade, and Revlimid?
Yeah, although traditional, the typical chemotherapy are actually the melphalan and Cytoxan. Velcade and Revlimid, although I think, you know, in lay terms we refer to them as chemotherapy, they actually work through slightly different mechanisms and clearly have a much better side effect profile. But I would say in general terms, it's probably reasonable to call those chemotherapy as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doctor. Would you tell the audience what your immunotherapy approach is and how it might vary from the other one that is very much in the news, and that's a CAR T-cell therapy?
Sure. So let me start off with what CAR T-cell therapy is. So CAR is an acronym that stands for chimeric antigen receptors. So obviously CAR is easier to remember and to say. And basically what CAR therapy is T cells that are engineered to recognize a certain protein that's present on the surface of the tumor cell. And then, so it recognizes it normally in the form of an antibody, and then the part of this molecule that's on the inside of the cell actually causes the T cell to proliferate when that receptor engages the protein that it can recognize. And for the most part, this approach has used blood cells from the blood, and for the most part, what this does is that it engages and recognizes only cells that express this one protein. As you mentioned, CAR T-cell therapy has gotten a lot of press because the results, certainly in a certain type of tumor, specifically acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, which is one of the most common childhood leukemias, has shown very dramatic results, and also with significant toxicities. But one of the problems with that approach is that as these patients relapse, they tend to relapse with a tumor that does not have the protein on the surface that was originally recognized by the CAR T cell. And in technical terms, that's called the development of antigen escape variants. So it's sort of like the same concept with antibiotics, that when you give antibiotics for a long time, you ultimately select out a population of bacteria that are resistant to the antibiotic. And with CAR T cells, you're selecting out a population of tumor cells that are resistant to the CAR T cells because they don't have the protein on the surface that the CAR T cell recognizes. In contrast, the approach that we've taken is an approach that we call MILS, which stands for marrow-infiltrating lymphocytes. And so the idea is, first of all, a lymphocyte T cells are lymphocytes. And so they're both, these are cells that are trained normally in the body to recognize, fight, and kill viruses and also tumor. And what we have been able to show is that these cells that come from the bone marrow have a much broader ability to recognize many, many more proteins on the surface of the tumor cells than do cells that are obtained from the blood. So in some early experiments that we did, we were basically able to show that if we took blood cells and activated them, turned them on in the laboratory, and then asked whether they recognized myeloma, there was virtually zero recognition of the myeloma. In contrast, when we did the same thing with MILS, we could see that approximately 70 to 80% of the cells that we were activating and putting in contact with the myeloma were able to recognize and to kill the myeloma upon encounter. So from a scientific perspective, the ability to recognize potentially hundreds, if not thousands, of proteins would make the likelihood of developing antigen escape variants significantly lower. The other important thing about MILS is that being that these cells come from the bone marrow and being that in myeloma, the bone marrow is where the disease is, it's much easier for these cells to actually go back to the bone marrow after they're put into the patient than theoretically a cell that's from the blood can do.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And isn't there something about myeloma, which is in the stroma of the bone marrow, tends to be more difficult to kill than that in the blood?
Well,
and that
yeah.
has something to, and as a result, that's why these MILS are a little bit more active.
So I think what you're alluding to is that there has been work done by several groups showing that the ability of the myeloma cells to attach to their surface, which specifically they're attaching to the stroma, these cells, this fact that they're attaching inherently gives the myeloma cell the ability to resist killing from either drugs or possibly even immunotherapy. In contrast, when a cell is detached from the bone marrow stroma, then their overall ability to die increases with the same approach. I'm not sure that we've actually shown that MILS can overcome this resistance, but what we have been able to show is that we can get very good trafficking and increase the concentration of these MILS into the bone marrow when it's given, either in mouse experiments or even in humans.
Okay, well, thank you. You use this therapy after autologous stem cell transplant. Why not a standalone therapy? Patients really do not like transplants.
Sure. No, absolutely. I can say that our ultimate goal would be to develop this and in the absence of a transplant. However, there is one feature of T-cell therapy that warrants mentioning, and that is that if you think about many organs in our body, they have a finite size, and the easiest example of this is the liver, that if somebody chops out half of the patient's liver, that liver will ultimately grow back to its normal size. And the same thing is true with lymphocytes, that if you think about now lymphocytes as filling up a glass, the amount of lymphocytes that are in the body are enough to fill up that glass. So what T-cell therapy needs is a way to increase the number of tumor-specific cells that can actually fight the cancer. And so one way of artificially doing this is not only to grow up the cells in the laboratory, which we can increase by anywhere from 50 to 200-fold, but also to allow the body to then allow these cells to further expand. And one way of doing that is by emptying the glass. So if we empty the glass by 50%, then we can get 50%, hopefully 50% expansion of these T cells even after we put them in. And if we completely empty the glass, then we can hopefully get 100-fold or 100% expansion of these lymphocytes after we put them in. So that's basically what transplant does. It empties the glass. So in addition to fighting myeloma, it also creates what's called technically lymphoid space that then allows for these T cells to further expand in the body in addition to having expanded in the blood, in the bags in the laboratory. Now, do we need a transplant? Likely not. A lot of CAR T cell therapy right now is being done not in the context of a transplant, but in the context of chemotherapy that nevertheless empties the glass by basically killing a lot of the lymphocytes. And so we are slowly moving in that direction of trying to see whether we can achieve similar things without requiring the transplant. But considering how transplant is a mainstay of therapy for many patients with myeloma, this was at least an easy place to start.
Does it also reduce the tumor burden then, and that is helpful?
The transplant?
Yes.
Clearly the transplant, you know, certainly has a known clinical benefit. So it does reduce the tumor burden. But really what the chemotherapy and the transplant does from an immunotherapeutic standpoint is that it might actually allow the immune cells to better recognize a tumor because of the way that chemotherapy can kill myeloma cells.
Okay. You have been pursuing this approach for years, and I think you started on lymphoma, I believe. Do you have any seasoned data which shows you are on the right track?
So our first clinical trial that we did was started in 2007, and that trial was very different from where we are right now. But what we were able to show from that trial was that patients that got at least a 90% reduction in their disease burden showed a benefit from the overall approach compared to patients that got less than a 90% reduction in their disease. And we published this data, I think it came out in May of this year, and what we're seeing is that there's a significant tail in terms of the overall survival of these patients. And I think what we'll do is probably try to update that data in the next year or two. But that tail of overall survival is better than what we would have expected sort of historically, although we don't technically have controls with that. We are now actually conducting a randomized trial, so this would really give us the better head-to-head comparison that will hopefully be maturing in the next 1 to 2 years.
Great. Well, thank you. I can tell you that I am very, very excited about your work, but I do not see why it has not gotten the attention of some of the CAR T-cell work, you know, because it doesn't have the, you know, some of the side effects, and why you're just not flooded with money from drug companies and everywhere so you can expedite your work. What gives?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I think part of it is that we haven't published as much on this as a lot of other people have. And I think, you know, the other big aspect of this is that there's the thing that I think has made CAR T-cells up, you know, in the front pages of a lot of news is that there's a wow phenomenon. I mean, there are patients in whom you give these cells, and with a matter of weeks, their disease is gone. I think, you know, our approach is much more of a marathon than it is of a sprint, and I don't think marathon runners get as much publicity oftentimes as sprinters do.
Okay. Yeah, you know, the other I know that you are getting some, I think the LLS is doing some work with you, but is this something that ultimately can be patented and companies would be just, you know, clamoring to support you if you show great results?
So we have patented various aspects of this, and there has been interest in licensing this technology to various companies, and I am actually very excited about the interest that we've seen over the past several months, and hopeful that we will eventually see this going into a company format where we could rapidly expand our research and hopefully look at this not just in myeloma, which is, you know, the disease that I also see clinically, and that's why it's the first disease that we've tested this in, but we're also beginning to explore the use of this in a variety of other disease settings as well.
All right. So those are my questions, and so I'd like to open it up to the panel for them to get some time with you. First off, Jack Ayala, are you online?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Let me clarify one thing you asked in your very first question, Gary, when you indicated, or you said daratumumab and elotuzumab have recently been approved by the FDA. I'm sure you're aware. Daratumumab has, elotuzumab has not yet, although they've applied for a new drug application. My question to Dr. Borello, are MILs still engineered to attack a particular antigen like CD38, or are they just expanded? You build more of them.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So the therapy that we're currently using, they're not engineered. And I think, you know, that is potentially one area that may be very attractive, I think, to industry, because it's a lot less labor-intensive and a lot less expensive to develop this approach than it is to engineer any kind of T-cell. And so the idea is that because it represents such a broad range of proteins that are present on the tumor cell, that we could potentially get away with not having to engineer that. Now, having said that, in my lab, we are also beginning to look at approaches of modifying the T-cells with genes that are recognizing certain proteins to turn them into better cells, to see whether that approach may offer some benefits. And I think, you know, one could theoretically hypothesize that there may be different settings in which you would want to use either gene-modified or non-gene-modified T-cells, depending upon where you want to give this therapy.
Are they susceptible to the cytokine storms I've read about, like with CAR T cells?
No. We are not seeing cytokine storms. So in the current randomized trial that we have, basically the approach is that everybody's getting a stem cell transplant with melphalan, which is the standard transplant that myeloma patients get. And then the patients that are randomized to the MILDS arm are getting these cells infused on days 3 and 4 after their stem cells are infused. And we do, here at Hopkins, we do our transplants as outpatients. And patients ultimately get hospitalized if there's any complications. The most common complication that one sees with transplant is the development of fevers. And I can tell you that what we're seeing is a significantly higher rate of hospitalization in the patients that are getting the MILDS compared to patients that aren't. And the reason for this is fevers and diarrhea. But all of these things are rate-limiting and basically go away on their own. And we have not had to actively treat anybody for this cytokine storm. So when I talk to my patients, I say that if one looks at the kinds of toxicities that CAR T cells are giving, and if you want to say that that's a 10, we're probably seeing about a 3 or a 4. So we are seeing something, but it's not the kind of thing that patients are ending up in intensive care units or requiring active intervention.
How are MILs physically extracted and then given back to you?
So MILs, they're called marrow-infiltrating lymphocytes, and so we get them from the marrow. So what we do is patients undergo a bone marrow aspiration, which is the typical bone marrows that most patients get. The difference is that an average bone marrow gets about 10 to 20 mLs of bone marrow. We're collecting 200 mLs of bone marrow. And before anybody cringes, the way we do this is all patients are getting what we call conscious sedation. So they're getting pain medications as well as sedative, sedating medication, just like they would if they were getting a colonoscopy. And the sedative medication is also slightly amnestic. So in other words, patients forget what's happening. And I can tell you that the average procedure takes about 10 to 15 minutes, the time in the bone marrow, and most patients, the only thing that they complain about is a little bit of soreness at the sites of the harvest and no actual pain because of the medications that they're given. So it's a very tolerable procedure.
How's it given back to you?
Oh, sorry. So then these cells are taken out, they're put in a bag, they're taken to the lab, and then they're grown and they're given back through the IV. So, it goes into the patient's veins and eventually finds its way into the bone marrow, just like stem cells are.
Well, it sounds exciting. Those are my questions. I know more will be asked, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Cindy? Jim Maluski,
yeah,
are you there?
I'm sure you could hear her. I'm trying to keep quiet. This is so exciting, this MILS therapy. And I have some questions, and excuse me, I answered them a little earlier. I signed on late. I thought it was at 6:30 instead of 6 o'clock. So my first question is, you're talking about some clinical trials for the MILS, and I was wondering if they're just being offered at Johns Hopkins or if there are other sites. And what would the time commitment mean being away from home to participate in the trial? And what kind of follow-up after the initial stem cell transplant and the MILS infusion would there be?
Yeah, so those are all very good questions. I can tell you that right now, this trial is only being offered here, but I'm hopeful it will be a multi-center trial, and the other two sites that are going to be opening it are Moffitt in Tampa, Florida, and Mayo Jacksonville, also in Florida. So for some reason, we ended up getting a Florida contingency. We just got approval from the various regulatory agencies to open the studies there, so I'm hopeful that at the latest by January, they should be open there. We are also talking possibly to some other sites to see what their interest would be in moving forward. In terms of the time commitment, what generally happens is if a patient is coming from out of town, the bone marrow harvest to collect the mills generally occurs about 6 weeks before the transplant procedure starts. So, for example, for my patients that are here, they would get their bone marrow harvested. And the reason why it takes 6 weeks is because we have to make sure that we have not contaminated the product. So the first thing that's done is after the bone marrow is collected, we send it off to a microbiology lab, and that testing lasts 2 weeks. And if after that two-week time frame the product is clean, then we can expand it, and the expansion is normally between 7 and 10 days. And then we have to send off the product, the expanded product, off to the microbiology lab to make sure that that hasn't been contaminated. So you can see that there's 4 weeks of basically sterility testing and a little over 1 week of growing the cells. And so that's where we come up with this six-week time frame. During that period of time, the patients start their pre-transplant workup to make sure that they are otherwise healthy enough to undergo transplant. And then they get the transplant. And the transplant, you know, time commitment would be the same, I think, wherever anybody was. They would, so if somebody were coming from out of town, they would stay here through the time that their cells come back up, which is normally around 3 to 4 weeks after the transplant. And then the study, because this is a study, the study time points in which we monitor for the disease and immune responses are at 2 months, 6 months, and 12 months. So those would be other visits that would be required for patients if they were to come from out of town. And then we are monitoring disease response quarterly, but that doesn't have to be here. It could be just getting notes from the patient's physician sent to us every 3 months until the patients are relapsing.
Okay, great. Do you know if there's a transplant house nearby that patients could stay at for that time?
There are.
Or would they be staying in a hotel? Or?
Well, no. So Hopkins, so, I mean, we get a lot of patients from a lot of different places. And so there is sort of hospital housing literally right across the street. But, I mean, obviously there's no guarantee that that will be available. And then there are a variety of housing opportunities available throughout the city. Generally, patients get significant discounts if they say that they're at Hopkins. And in some cases, I think, and don't quote me necessarily on this, but insurance companies may actually pay for that because it's certainly a lot cheaper than a night in the hospital itself.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, are the trials for a newly diagnosed myeloma patients, relapsed refractory, or both?
So these are trials for anybody. The current trial, the way it's written, is for anybody that has never received a transplant. Now, most patients get transplanted sort of as part of their upfront therapy. But if for whatever reason they didn't get a transplant initially and relapse and otherwise meet the criteria for the trial, then they would be eligible for the trial, even at relapse, as long as they have not had a transplant.
So besides the transplant as an exclusion criteria, are there other exclusion
criteria?
Yes. Criteria.
Yes. The other major exclusion criteria are would be the absence of autoimmune disease. Because we're giving immunotherapy, you know, we don't want to make patients' underlying autoimmune disease worse. So if patients have lupus or multiple sclerosis, scleroderma, those kinds of that are actively being treated, those would be exclusion criteria. And other than that, patients basically need to be healthy enough and to meet the criteria for transplant. And so the other exclusion criteria are basically transplant criteria.
Okay. So if they're non-secretor, that would be okay as long as you could measure things in their bone marrow or...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
For non-secretors.
Is an exclusion. I'm sorry. So the patients also have to have at least a history of a measurable disease. So patients that are non-secretory myeloma, unfortunately, are not included in the study.
Okay, and is there a minimum M spike you have to have, like a 1.0 or?
Nope, they just have to have had a history of an M spike. So if a patient had a myeloma, let's say with an M spike of 1, and go into complete remission, but otherwise meet the criteria. And the criteria for the current trial is that they have to have high-risk myeloma. Then in that case, they would be eligible for the study, even if they come to us in complete remission.
Okay. High-risk by the MSMART criteria?
No,
or?
It's high-risk by FISH. So we're looking at a 1Q amplification, a 414 translocation, a 1416 translocation, a 17P deletion, or if they have high risk based on the gene expression profiling. And the one that we're currently using is the one that was developed in Arkansas called the MyPRS.
Okay. And finally, after the transplant and they're back at home, is there any maintenance therapy as part of the trial?
There is. Patients are going on Revlimid as maintenance therapy, starting at around 2 months.
Okay, and that's the part of the trials.
Yes.
Revlimid. How about for patients who stopped responding to Revlimid prior to the trial? They would still use Revlimid
as maintenance?
They would
still use Revlimid, yes. The reason we're giving Revlimid, it's twofold. One, I'm sure many of the people listening are aware of the randomized data that was generated by both the French as well as by American studies showing that patients treated with Revlimid maintenance had a longer progression-free survival compared to patients that weren't. So in other words, it took longer for the disease to come back. So it was actually in that study it was 48 versus 24 months. So that's one reason, and I think in many places throughout the world, not all, but many, Revlimid maintenance has now become the standard of care. But the other important reason why we're doing this is because Revlimid is actually a drug that augments immune response. And so the idea would be that by giving this therapy, we could increase the overall efficacy of these mills for a much longer period of time.
Okay, great. There are my questions. Back to you, Gary.
Thanks, Cindy. Pat Killingsworth, you online?
I am. Can you hear me, Gary?
Yeah, sure can.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Doctor. I guess I just have one question. So what, if someone participates in the study, what is considered a goal? What would be a good outcome, and what percentage of patients would you anticipate would achieve that outcome?
So being that this is a randomized trial where we have two arms to the study, one either gets the mills with the transplant or the other one doesn't, what we're comparing, and the primary endpoint of this study is looking at progression-free survival, which is the medical term to basically state how long it takes for the disease to come back. So what we're hoping is that when everything is said and done, that there are more patients that are disease-free on the arm that got mills compared to the arm that didn't get the mills. So that's the primary endpoint of the study. We are also in the process of opening sort of two sub-studies after that. And specifically, I would like to spend some time talking about that because I think it's important for the listeners. As I mentioned, the primary endpoint is progression-free survival. So technically, once we've reached that metric, the patients can then go on to whatever therapy they choose. So for the patients, but what I've been telling the patients is that the patients that were randomized to getting a standard transplant, they are eligible to get their mills at the time of relapse. So really, everybody can get the mills. But the mills given at the time of relapse are given in the non-transplant setting. So what we're doing is we're giving some high doses of chemotherapy, but not enough to require the stem cells in combination with the mills. We are in the process of modifying that arm of the study to also include anti-PD-1, which is an antibody that has shown significant success in many diseases, including melanoma, the skin cancer, certain types of lung cancer. It was just approved, I think, today for kidney cancer. And there will be data presented at our annual ASH meeting, the American Society of Hematology, next week, showing that in combination with Revlimid, this anti-PD-1 has about a 70% response rate. So the idea would be to see whether MILS plus anti-PD-1 with Revlimid can show an even more dramatic response. So that's another thing that the patients that are on the study would be eligible for. And for the patients that are on the arm that got MILS with the transplant, they would then be eligible to get PD-1 with Revlimid at the time of relapse as well.
So is that 40, what you said, 24 and 48? Is that 48 months out?
So because we're targeting a high risk patient population, that time frame is actually going to be shortened. The average time for relapse for the population that we're targeting is somewhere around a year and a half, so somewhere between 16 and 20 months. So that's the median time for relapse for these patients. And so the idea would be that either before that time or after that time, whenever they relapse, that we would be giving them this other therapy that I just mentioned.
Sure, because once a high-risk patient relapses, it tends to, everything tends to be accelerated. I understand that.
Correct.
Thank you.
And thank you, Pat. Now Jenny Ahlstrom on the call? Jenny, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I sure can. And Jenny is a special guest tonight. She had worked with Dr. Barella on the Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative to find high-risk projects that were the best, that were at least not funded as of yet. And Dr. Barella is one of those, and we have an opportunity now to have Jenny ask some questions. So, Jenny, fire away.
Okay. Well, Dr. Barella, thanks for joining this show. It's a real treat to be able to hear more about these projects. And I do want to say that just part of the process, we're just patients who want a cure. And for the Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative, we gathered a group of top myeloma experts and then some very highly educated patients, including this group of panelists, and said, what should we go after? And and the doctors said, hands down, high-risk myeloma, because these patients are not having good outcomes. So we did that. And out of 36 proposals, Dr. Barella's proposal was one of two proposals that were selected as the most exciting. So we are very, very excited about what you're doing. My questions would be, the first, when you think about CAR T cell and you think you're pulling them out, you're engineering them to go after the certain protein, I remember in the show that we did, you said you pull them out, you grow them up in the presence of the tumor cells. How does that work? How do they know what to go after? Because what you're saying is that it could go after potentially hundreds of targets that particular patient might have. That's going to be completely different than the patient sitting next to them in the infusion room. So how do your T cells know what to go after? I guess that's my first question.
Yeah, so I don't know the answer to that question, other than to say that, that was a concern when we first started doing our first clinical trial, that because we are growing the cells within the bone marrow environment, so we are not taking these cells out, we are growing them within all the components of the bone marrow that are there, and, even a myeloma patient has normal bone marrow elements, because otherwise they wouldn't have blood counts. The concern was that we would potentially be activating these cells and cause, for example, the patients to not have any platelets or not have any red cells or anything like that. The one thing that I can say to you is that when we have now treated probably close to about 80 or 90 patients, that we do not see any delay in engraftment. So in other words, the amount of time that it normally takes for the white cells or the hemoglobin or the platelets to come up are not delayed in patients getting males compared to those that don't. And that may be due to the fact that these T cells, these MILs that are there, specifically recognize abnormal components that are present on the tumor cells. And that if you think about how our immune system has been developed, it's really developed to recognize what's called in immunological terms self from non-self. So that's the reason why we don't normally react against our eyes or our lungs or our heart or anything else. And when we do, it's a disease. It's called autoimmune disease. And so that, I think, is the major explanation, that the MILs are recognizing something foreign or something not right with these plasma cells. And so when we're able to turn them on, and this whole process of growing the cells actually does two things. One, it wakes them up, and two, it expands them. That we are able to turn them on and to increase the percentage of the cells that are actually recognizing the tumor cells themselves, and to do this in a way that is safe, as demonstrated by the absence of toxicity.
Okay, that's great. And a second question is, are you planning on having this available for relapsed refractory patients who have already had a transplant? Because, you know, I have friends who are going to their second, third transplant, and in my mind, I wouldn't want to do a standard transplant. I would want to do a standard transplant plus something really promising and exciting like this project.
Yeah, so right now, as I mentioned earlier, for the patients that get transplanted without MILs, we're basically giving them these cells in the absence of a transplant. I think if this looks promising, then I could certainly envision a subsequent trial being just in the transplant setting and in the relapse setting and not involving transplant. So that would certainly be our intention.
Oh, okay. So you wouldn't have to go to another transplant necessarily.
Correct.
But you could get the sufficiently heavy dose of chemo and then get them afterwards.
Correct.
And with your phase 2 study that you're running right now, when do you anticipate having some of those results set?
Well,
I'm
hoping...
knowing kind of what your next step is.
Right. So we have, this trial is a 90-patient trial, and to date we've enrolled roughly half of the patients. And I'm hoping that for ASH of next year, so again, ASH is in December, that we will at least have data that we could present that would be representative of a little over half of the patients. And at that point, to begin to get an idea of how to move in the next direction.
Okay, great. Well, I would like patients who are listening to know that if they'd like to help fund your research, that they can do that. Our goal in picking these two projects is to help you get $250,000 to move your research forward so you can do it much faster. And because of the process, you know, it's sometimes pharma companies get funding and will do their own drug development, but you're really working on this and trying to make it, give it a go with other foundation funding and probably institutional funding and your own street smarts. So we would love to help support you. And if other patients want to do that, they can do that on the Myeloma Crowd site.
Well, I want to thank you, first of all, for being selected and for all your support. And it's true. I mean, these are rather expensive therapies, and there are not a lot of sources of funding. So clearly that is a rate-limiting step often in terms of moving forward.
Yeah, it's clear, I think, that it's tough for investigators to do the research that they want to do just because there is limited funding. And if as patients we want to cure faster, I think it's a great thing to do is to get involved and help raise funds for things that look completely promising like this. So, Kerry,
well,
I didn't have any other questions.
Okay, well, Jenny, thank you so much, and what we'll like to do now is go to some of the questions from our listeners. Priya?
Thank you, Gary. Dr. Borello, we have a few questions from our listeners. Some of them I think we have already covered. One of our listeners wants to know, how long are the MILs active in the body, in the patient's body?
That's a very good question. The short answer is I don't know with certainty because these cells are not in any way marked, gene marked. But I can tell you from our first study, when the last time point, that the latest time point that we looked at was at a year following transplant, we were still able to see myeloma-specific MILs in the bone marrow, and the patients that had the more of them, in other words, the patients with the greatest anti-myeloma response immunologically were the ones that had the best clinical outcomes. So at least out to 1 year, we could detect these cells, potentially even further.
Yeah, I think we did touch upon a little bit about side effects, but just a new question has come in, asking what about the side effects of this treatment?
Not many. We're seeing a slight increase in fevers, maybe a little bit of diarrhea, but all of this has been rate limiting. We have not had to specifically treat anybody for any of the side effects that we've experienced.
Okay. We have one of our panelists' questions unanswered. Matt Goldman, who was also a cancer myeloma survivor, was supposed to join us but could not. He wanted to ask, what does expanded and enhanced T cells actually mean?
So what enhanced means, so let's start off with a basic concept in immunology, and that is that normally what happens in cancer patients is that the tumors secrete a series of proteins that ultimately paralyze the immune system. And this process, in technical terms, is called the development of tumor-associated energy. So we say that these T-cells are anergic. So what we're doing is taking them out of the body and turning them on. So they go from a drunken state to an awake state, and that's the process of enhancement. And then the expansion is that we actually increase their numbers. So they go from, let's say, 100 million cells to 10 billion cells. And so we're hoping that a combination of waking them up and giving more of them will increase the likelihood of achieving a measurable anti-tumor effect.
And he wants to know if the T cells are tainted by the myeloma.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Whether the T cells are tainted by the myeloma.
Oh, well, in the body they are.
Yeah.
And so this process of activation and expansion in the lab hopes to reverse that process, yes.
Okay. Gary, the panelists, if they have any more questions, they can actually ask Dr. Borrello. We have a few minutes more.
Okay, any other panelists?
I'm good.
Okay.
The listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Borrello, please plus one on your keypads and we can bring you live. Yes, we have a caller online. Caller calling in from 907-209-9890. Please ask your question.
Yes, thank you very much. This is Eric Hansen and Jill. I kind of lost track of the timeline. I wondered if you could just briefly go through your research goals in terms of now you're doing first transplants only, and you were talking about being able to do this for refractory patients at some point that have already been through the transplants. Do you have a sense of how long it will take your research to get to the point where you're ready to treat refractory patients without another transplant?
Yeah, so in the current trial, as I mentioned earlier, it's randomized, and so the patients that get transplanted without the MILs are then already, they will be getting the MILs in the absence of a transplant. And so, but the eligibility for this whole process is requires a transplant. But what I'm hopeful is that at the end of this study, we will see that even the patients that get the MILs without the transplant are achieving a benefit, and that we could then open up another study. As to the timeline for that, A lot of it depends, one, on how quickly this trial accrues. And I'm hopeful that by the end, by this time next year, we will be close to that time frame. And two, what the overall efficacy is of this approach in the non-transplant setting. But I would say, assuming that both of those things are positive, I would hope that by the end of next year at this time, we would begin planning for our non-transplant trial and would be starting that basically in sometime in 2017.
All right, great. And that, do you think that trial a year from now could involve multi-centers, or will it be limited to your own center for the time being?
I would hope that it would involve multi-centers.
Great. Thank you very much. That's all I have.
You're welcome.
Doctor, there's one last question.
Okay,
yeah,
it
just came in. It was just been posted on our website. Listener wants to ask if this MILS treatment ultimately be curative for high-risk patients. Will subsequent booster infusions lead at least to a functional cure?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, my hope is that what we will be able to show is that we could significantly impact the disease with this approach. And then I think one question would be whether patients that have shown evidence of achieving a benefit from this would benefit from multiple infusions afterwards. So that certainly would be one of the goals of the study.
Thank you. Gary, you had a question?
Yes. Doctor, one of the things that has come up in recent literature anyway is that if you can somehow find the disease early, you know, during its MGUS or smoldering phase when it hasn't had a time to multiply and have more clones and more resistant clones, that this kind of therapy might in fact be used as a kind of a prophylactic, and that you could kind of nip the disease in the bud with this, because you got low disease burden and your immune system has yet to be totally compromised.
That's true. And so, I mean, clearly, if we're seeing evidence of benefits, I think one of the dramatic differences that hopefully would work to our advantage in this case over CAR T cells is that this is a much more benign therapy, and so one can certainly envision delivering such a therapy in a much earlier part of the disease setting, i.e., in the smoldering myeloma stage, where toxicity is not an issue because we already know what the toxicity profile is of this approach. So absolutely.
Well, good. Well, you know, like I said, I just don't understand myself why, you know, it takes societies like the Lymphoma Society and now MCRI, Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative, to provide funding when, to me, you know, this, you know, there should be people just storming to your door, you know, because, you know, you patent this process. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of money to be made. And that's from my business background. But apparently people are starting to see that. And I think that is probably one of the reasons that, you know, you haven't seen that, you know, that immunotherapy in general has been slow to start, because it's not a pill. It's not something that you're going to find a lot of pharma's companies going after. But, you know, that's just a little bit of my own personal belief.
I would agree with you.
Thank you, Gary. Dr. Borrello, thank you so very much. This is very exciting research, and hopefully, I'm sure it will be a breakthrough myeloma treatment going forward. Gary, Jack, Pat, Cindy, and Jenny, thank you very much for your participation. And today's talk will be made available along with its transcript on the CureTalks website. Please visit curetalks.com for details of upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Priya.
Thank you.
Thank you.